Welcome to the Sum of It All Take Two podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're revisiting an entire past season in each episode, sharing what we think now, along with new resources, connections, and opportunities. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're revisiting season 7. Teaching Math to Multilingual Students. When we read and discussed the book, Teaching Math to Multilingual Students, Positioning English Learners for Success by Catherine B. Chavall, Erin Smith, Lina Trigos-Carrillo, and Rachel J. Pinnow. A great read for us to revisit. It's always timely for our listeners and us as we consider how we teach math to our multilingual learners. So Mark, I'm super curious, what's something that is still resonating with you from season 7?
Well, Audrey, even though season 7, it was a few months ago, right? Mm-hmm. There's many aspects of our discussions that we had in season seven that we tend to revisit on a regular basis, Audrey. I mean, this is not a topic we just said, oh, we're going to read this book and we're going to talk about it then. This is really part of our regular discussions, right? Ensuring our multilingual learners are supported so that they can reveal their brilliance in their practice of mathematics. I mean, and that's really our goal, right? The conversation that we seem to keep getting into is, and as we are out in supporting districts and schools, and we're talking to other educators, I think one of the things that I find that we continue to have a discussion around is, when do we support the development of language, and how and when do we support the development of mathematical reasoning? You know, how do those two things work together? I think that's something that we have frequent discussions about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a quote from season 7 that's really still resonating around this, Audrey, of sort of thinking about those two sides of the coin, right? And on page 90, the quote is, "Teachers can be quicker to evaluate a student's answer as an equivalence concept rather than as a language challenge when that student speaks English as their first or only language." And I remember when we had this discussion, Audrey, that quote really sparked a discussion about thinking about when we determine whether a student needs support with language or support in developing a math concept, and how if the student was an English speaker primarily, that might be something we would think about differently than we would think of as with supporting a multilingual learner. So that really, I know, pushed us into that discussion of really considering how we determine that idea of supporting language versus the mathematical concept.
Yeah, you know, as I was looking through my notes and our transcripts from this season, I had like the stars on this post-it note that says critical all over chapter 7, where you pulled this quote from. And,
right,
there's these three bullet points there that say, like, when a student is struggling and they happen to identify as a multilingual learner, sometimes it's because of the math. Sometimes it's because of the language. And actually there's a third one. Sometimes it's just something else, right? Because multilingual learners has a limitation, as any label does, that we cannot describe succinctly the individuals who might carry or identify as a multilingual learner, right?
True. Yeah.
Any student can have a bad night of sleep. Any student can have an argument with a friend before class, right? Like not a good breakfast. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And that might be clouding their thinking or making it more difficult to make connections. And so I think it's super important, and I'm so glad you brought this up, Mark, is that like our labels are only as good as the acronym they spell, right? Like there's so much more to them.
Yeah, I'm really glad you took it to that space, Audrey. In addition to what you said, which was great, I also wonder about like these labels as they become acronyms. We've kind of seen this movie before, right? With the acronym EL or ELL, that it sometimes in some spaces became the deficit label that we started using. And even though multilingual learner has more of a positive frame to it. I acknowledge that. I wonder, though, as we send it to the acronym of MLL, will we use it just to be the code for struggling students? And then instead of EL, we'll say MLL. And I just kind of worry about that.
I think that's important to worry about that. I think part of what we need to do as educators is to continue to confront our implicit bias and to think about whether or not I am using a label, if I'm using that as a substitute for deficit thinking, and I think this text provided us several opportunities for us to check our own biases. One space that came up for me was in chapter two. There was a quote here. I'm going to read it. It's a little bit longer, but I'm going to read it anyways because I think it's valuable. It said from chapter two, "Sometimes teachers in our experience have mentioned that they are concerned about calling on multilingual learners to share their mathematical ideas because it takes them longer to compose and speak their answers in English. However, we have found that making space for multilingual learners to share their ideas positions them as contributors to the classroom ecology, which shapes how their peers treat them. It also shapes their mathematical identity, which is vital to participating in ways that foster mathematical learning and second language learning." And, you know, that quote, Mark, like I can go back in my career and remember times when I was like, oh, I got to put all these extra things in space in place so that my multilingual learners are not afraid to speak. Right. And, oh, I can't ask this question to the student. Their name came up on my equity sticks. We'll put the big quotes around that. And I can't call on them because I haven't given them a chance to talk out with their partner first. Right. And so I remember when we were reading Building Thinking Classrooms back for season one, mm-hmm. we discussed at one point whether or not multilingual learners, along with others, would need time to process individually a task before jumping right. into group work. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I realize now, as I'm reflecting both on this book and our reading of this book and this particular quote, that I might have had some bias hidden in there around like how I feel like it's necessary to scaffold for students who are multilingual learners. And that I actually might have been unintentionally designing scaffolding that changes their positionality, which is one of the things those authors talk about, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. I think that's really such a great point, Audrey. And you're even making me think about this whole notion of calling on kids to begin with. I wonder if it's helpful to think about like why we're even in a whole class situation, why we're calling on kids. Cold calling really is what we're mm-hmm. doing, right? We're you know, calling on kids perhaps with their hands up or not their hands up, but cold calling meaning like their hand isn't raised. And I think that's a pretty common practice. And it seems like it's a move to either see if kids are paying attention or a way to get students to contribute something that oftentimes is really just an answer to a teacher having a guess what's in my head question. So I wonder about this whole idea of calling on students, because I think it's good that we think about who we're calling on it and are we doing that in an equitable way? And to your point earlier, like, are we making sure we give enough space for students to explain their thinking if they're still looking and trying to make sure they have the right language to express what they're saying. But I'm struggling with the fact that the actual calling on students to begin with may not be very productive. And as you brought in Building Thinking Classrooms, I'm thinking about how in those groups, there could be perhaps much more language being produced by all students. And that seems to be a better format than a teacher just calling on students.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. So I think related to that, I think lots of educators are convinced that talking about math matters. I think that's something that folks have now,
true.
We've turned the tide on that, I think, a little bit.
Yeah.
That students need to have time and opportunity to use language to make sense of math, all of that, like it's necessary. That's an argument I'm having less and less with folks, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I wonder how often we like sit back and interrogate the strategies we're using to invite talk into our math classrooms. Like I just wonder, like, like you're pointing out like this cold calling. Like I can just imagine teachers saying like, I want there to be discussion in my class. So-and-so, can you please respond to this question? Let's get the conversation going, right? How often do we sit back and look at that and say like, is that really a good strategy, right? And you could pick any strategy from the book, you know, the sticks, the cards, the choose a partner, the turn and talk, the whatever. How are those strategies positioning our students as thinkers and doers of mathematics or not? I think that's an important question to pause and consider once in a while, because I think otherwise we get into the habits of this is how I invite talk into my class. And I think we push ourselves further and further and further into what we're comfortable with rather than what's right and comfortable for our students.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, the other thing I'm thinking about is, you know, I said a moment ago, like the amount of language that would happen with kids that are, you know, in their vertical space when they're standing there in a building thinking classroom environment, and how they have this opportunity to jump into the conversation when it makes sense for them to jump into. I think many times our whole group conversations are pretty contrived. And we, as the educator, are controlling when you get to be part of this discussion and be part of that. I think that really creates a barrier for multilingual learners to produce language when they're making meaning in the moment. And I think that that's really something to think about, and based on what you were saying.
Yeah, there's so many connections here, Mark, in terms of like, how do we look at our classroom interactions and consider the assets of our students, and does everyone have access to the learning? And so much of this ties into me for our conversations around universal design for learning, or UDL, that like, if you have a learning goal in mind, that then you sit back and you consider all the barriers, and then you design to minimize those barriers, right? So sometimes language is a barrier. But sometimes I think we as the teachers are also a barrier. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
And I think that's what we're trying to talk about when we say shifting away from teacher-centered classrooms. I think sometimes we take up too much airtime. We take up too much space, identity, math space in the classroom, and that we have to cede it to our students essentially and give it up so that there's room for them to build their mathematical identities. And yeah.
Yeah. I think that makes sense, because I think it's back to, we're talking about that controlling of the calling on students. It's this very adult-centered conversation that is very, very rigid in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of this is reminding me of how, you know, we're supporting a school district right now and really working to improve the student-to-student discourse in mathematics. And that work that we're doing right now, Audrey, it's reminded me that it's really challenging to figure out how to move past something like sentence stems. So you were talking about like sometimes students need support with language. And many times we use sentence stems as a way to support that discourse in the classroom, right? Whether they be with a partner in a whole group situation. And these stems are very helpful to get conversations started. But one of the things that is a barrier, I think, is being able to know when to remove those scaffolds and ensure like more of that authentic interactive discourse happens with that student thinking. And I think that's particularly hard to do in that whole class environment we were talking about, because I think it becomes teachers saying, now, are you using your stems and looking up to the chart and using the stems? And which again is actually pretty critical in the beginning for students to produce language, but then how do we move past the stems? And maybe that's what's so great about the math language routines that we've talked about before, Audrey. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they're underutilized, and it's not new, which I think always surprises people. I mean, relatively new. I think some of the papers and research comes back to the 2010s, you know, like 16, 17.
Yeah.
But it's not like it just came out yesterday. And so I don't think we're seeing it at large scales yet, but I do know that when folks have sat down and said like, how do I elevate language and math at the same time, these math language routines are by far the best things I've seen out there that really help us to think deeply about how we're providing space for our learners to develop in both of those areas. And absolutely fascinating. So if folks haven't looked them up yet and read about them. They're in more spaces than they used to be. I used to only be able to find them through Stanford's Understanding Language group, but I think now they're on Achieve the Core and other spaces. They're even embedded in some curriculums, as I'm learning to understand. So something to think about as we really think about how we're designing our lessons. And this idea of positioning, I think that's related to that, because I think when we're designing for language and math at the same time, we're really thinking about how we build our students, provide opportunities for our students to build and grow, moves us into thinking deeply about how we intentionally or unintentionally position our students as capable or incapable, valued as and respected or ignored. And, there are so many actions that are sometimes subtle that position our students either in a place of authority and power or not. I really think that the math language routines are a space that kind of builds from assets and positions our students as learners, building upon what they already know, as opposed to like passive recipients or a blank slate, perhaps.
Yeah. Well said. I think, as I'm thinking about that positioning piece, and I was looking back at episode two, Audrey, and we talked a lot about positioning in that chapter two and episode two. And I think it also has to do with how we make decisions of when to support and when to scaffold, and what messages we send to students when we decide to support or scaffold. And one quote that I think is helping me think about this is on page 13, and it says, "Our words, gestures, silences, gaze, and so on can all convey what we believe about ourselves and others. Thus, in every classroom, teachers position students. It is a matter not of if a teacher positions, but how a teacher positions." And I think the thing I'm thinking about now with that, Audrey, in our discussion is, we usually in this discussion come back to this idea of formal mathematical language and when's the when with that, and the how of how that's introduced to students. And I think that this idea of positioning students, there could be some negative aspects of that with the idea of formal math vocabulary. Because here's what I'm thinking, Audrey, if we are communicating to students that you must understand particular mathematical formal vocabulary before you engage in exploring a concept, we're kind of positioning a student already in a position of like, if you can't learn this vocabulary, then you can't explore this concept. So for example, like students can engage in problem solving involving fractions before ever knowing the symbolic notation of fractions or even the formal terms of numerator and denominator. But if we are like positioning our students so that, no, you must know these words, and if a student's having trouble remembering them because they basically have no concept of them and cannot connect them to any other learning of theirs, then what's happening is we're actually positioning them in a deficit space. So I just think that when we get into conversations around this work, I think that we're not always been able to communicate with each other about this idea of a language development and language goals. And we want to support the language of all of our students as they engage in meaning making ahead of that formal language being labeled. And I think it's really important for us to consider to see how can we communicate with each other so that we can make sure that we're understanding each other and supporting our students.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark, because now you're pushing on something that I'm rethinking from this season, which is that like by the time we got done with this season, I started to see this parallel between multilingual learners and our students with disabilities. And what I started seeing and I'm rethinking now is that like we have in so many spaces in education separated these fields like of there's someone to support language development. There's a teacher for that. There's a department for that in a district, right? There's people to support students with disabilities. There's a department for that. There's, there's people who do that. And then there's the teachers. that are doing this other work, right?
Yeah,
And
right.
when we have it separated like that, we don't have conversations that are so vital to making sure that we are staying up with what really needs to happen. So like you and I talked about this in previous seasons with students with disabilities, like there's so much research for students with disabilities that is around a very old archaic way of teaching mathematics. And all of the research supports how you support students with disabilities with that kind of mathematics. And when we stop and say like, but that's not the math we're doing in class anymore. We're trying to make the math in class more like the math of the world, right? Like that inside and outside the classroom, it's the same, that it's problem solving and it's creative and it's innovative. Our folks in the students with disabilities departments are like, but that's not what our research says. And we're like, but your research isn't talking about the same math, right? There's this huge disconnect, right? And there's nothing that connects the two because we've so separated the two departments. And what I'm starting to rethink, I guess, as part of this season is how much we've separated the work of language development and language learning from mathematics, right? And so when we don't have these conversations together, like how often are folks who are supporting multilingual learners perhaps promoting strategies to develop language and support multilingual learners in math that are actually supporting the old archaic way of math? Like you're talking about the formal language first in all cases, right? The procedures first and algorithms first. So I'm really rethinking that and thinking about how we maybe bridge that gap between the separation.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Audrey. I just think it's like, how do we press pause and get everybody in the same room and really make sure we're all under the understanding of like, when we are supporting our students in mathematics today, what is the end goal? Because I think if we could renorm that, Audrey, and then kind of build from there, I think we could be more on the same page regarding language supports because we could see what the end is in mind, right?
Yeah, I appreciate that. There's one other thing I'm rethinking, and it has to do with bright spots, which has been our tagline for season 7. And it was connection back to Dan and Chip Heath's work in the book Switch, where they talked about like, look for where things are working, you call them the bright spots, and you investigate why and how they work so that you can leverage that brightness in other situations. And I think one of the things I'm rethinking as I, you know, consider that work again, is that Dan and Chip Heath never suggested that we directly replicate it. Like if you find a bright spot in this village that's doing something around sanitation, you can't do the exact same thing in another city, right? Like the contexts are so different and replication across the context doesn't work. But I think we try to do that in education. And I think sometimes we are like, oh, there's a bright spot. I'm going to do exactly what I see that person doing and forgetting that the contexts are different. And so I think a highlight of this book for me was that we were in classrooms in the book so often, like they highlighted students, they highlighted teachers. And I'm so appreciative of that.
Yeah, for sure.
But then I'm thinking about how do we take what we need to take from that and then translate it into various contexts so that we really can learn from bright spots. And I'm rethinking how we do that too.
Yeah, gosh, Audrey, that is such a good point about bright spots. I had not thought about it that way. And I just think it's so smart to bring it back to education because we are completely not doing that the right way. We so struggle with this. We ourselves all the time find ourselves talking about all of us in education, right? Like, what does it look like? What should this implementation look like? And we're not often given time to unpack the rationale and the nuances with any particular instructional practice. So we want the video. We want to be able to run into somebody's classroom and see it. We want to just be able to run out of there and go replicate it. We want to see what it looks like so we can just replicate what we see. And I'm really glad you brought us back to that, the real purpose underneath bright spots, because I think that might slow us down a little bit and not, it's not about replicating the same exact thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm super appreciative of the chance to look back at this particular season and a chance to think more about how we really position our multilingual learners as mathematical thinkers and doers, and how we push ourselves to continue to interrogate our practices on the ways that we are influencing the positionality of our students and all of our students, but in particular in this season, our multilingual students. So super appreciative.
Yeah. You know, Audrey, you know, I think what I like to say is I think in some ways like this season is really one of our most important to reflect on, because I just believe currently we're not positioning our multilingual learners for success. And I don't mean that as a blame game. I mean, I think we all have not been able to do that. And we've got to know better so we can do better for our students, right? So it's really important for those with language acquisition expertise and those of us with mathematical teaching and learning expertise continue to work through like that messy place of overlap that I think we've spent this episode talking about, that overlap between our fields to ensure we are all working toward the same end, right?
Yeah, a great point and a great way for us to wrap up with a call for more collaboration to move forward.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we'll chat about Season 8, Universal Design for Learning. Until then, send us a tweet with the hashtag SumMathChat. That's hashtag SumMathChat with your questions and thoughts. We'll keep the conversation going there. Until then, best wishes on learning from bright spots.